It was confirmation hearing week for the next Supreme Court justice, which means bring out the clowns. Adorable ACB Amy Coney Barrett absolutely schooled the Democratic senators asking questions of her this week, which does bring up the point that I do believe she owes her 7 homeschooled kids an apology. Apparently, she told them there is no such thing as a stupid question. Now she knows better. Well, we will uncover this great week in this week's debriefing of the law. Well, welcome to this week's debriefing of the law, and this is the week where there was an announcement in the Senate confirmation proceedings of let's get ready to rumble. There was that's what you always get with confirmation proceedings. It is a great grand fight spectacle for all involved. So Mackenzie Smith and I are going to unpack that today. Mackenzie, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Mackenzie, when we were doing our prep session before we were went on air here, we were talking about what is going on, and you mentioned to me next week is your big week. Is that right? What are you doing next week? Go ahead and tell our listeners.
I am running my first marathon, probably my first and only marathon.
Wow.
And I use the term run very loosely.
No. You don't understand who you're talking to. I went with my wife this morning, went for a 5-mile run/walk. We have a lot of fun. We're out there before anyone else is up. It's pitch black outside, but our pace is about 13 minutes and 37 seconds. When you add in the walking and the running, I'm guessing your pace is somewhere less than that.
It is somewhere less than that. So I had originally signed up to run the Marine Corps Marathon, which is on Sunday the 25th, but as you can imagine, everything has gone virtual this
right.
year, including races. So I will be running it in my hometown instead. And I have some family members and friends who are going to be running different segments of it with me.
I'll
be the only one running the whole thing. But yeah, I have people coming out for a couple miles here and there.
So you have them stationed at certain mile markers along the way so that when you pass that mile marker, they'll be there waiting for you. And then they'll run that mile with you. That's a great idea.
Yeah, it actually, I did it a few weeks ago with just a friend of mine. I was out for an 18-mile run, and he joined me for 4 miles, like right in the middle. And then my sister joined me for the last mile and a half. And it was so great. It just really made it go so much faster.
Wow.
And it was, we could chat a little bit. But yeah,
so you're a talker.
That makes it a lot more bearable.
You're a talker when you run.
I learned that there's actually truth to the saying it's a marathon, not a sprint. I did not really fully understand what I was getting myself into. It's always just been on my bucket list to finish a marathon before I turn 40. So when we went into quarantine back in March, I started running again. I had bought a jogging stroller, which I was using with my baby, and I kind of got into it and was going a little bit longer and longer every week and thought might as well just keep going and get this over with this year. I've got nothing else to do. I'm not going to the gym because of COVID. So, that started, but I'd only done, some 10Ks and half marathons, and I didn't realize how slow you actually have to run in order for your body to be physically able to finish 26.2. Like, it's really, really far. So I am, normally I wouldn't chit chat, but I am going slow enough where I can handle it for a couple miles at this point.
I am definitely a talker when I run, partly because I am just not fast. I have literally tried to sprint before, and my sprint pace is 7.5 miles per minutes per mile. So I am not fast in the slightest bit. I know a lot of people who can run a marathon less than a 7:30 clip. And that is my dead sprint pace. But so I actually ran a half marathon here in Kansas City several years back. And I wonder if your experience is going to be the same, because my experience was different. When we started, there were 10,000 people at the starting line, and there were bands playing almost every mile. There'd be a different band there. People would be in their windows, hanging out of their windows, cheering you on. There were people in costumes running. What is this? How is the marathon going to be now that we have COVID at the same time?
Yeah, I mean, I've run several half marathons, including the Mardi Gras half marathon in New Orleans, which was my first half marathon, plus the Philadelphia a bunch of times. And you get such a good vibe from all the people.
Yeah.
You're all mashed together at the start line and people are cheering you on for the last couple miles and you just feel so inspired. This is not going to be that, but you know, I think there's something to be said for just having the time to, you know, kind of be in your own head and process things. There's not a lot of silence in our lives these days, especially if you have a bunch of kids and you've been quarantined with them for seven months. So I do kind of look forward to my long run every week, and I put on music or a podcast that I've been saving. And it does, I mean,
it's good.
Four and a half hours is a really long time.
Four and a half hours running.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I'm just tired. I'm tired listening to that. I remember when I ran my half marathon, and I only did it once because I'm a big guy. I mean, big guys are not meant to be running long distances. I remember when I got done with my 13.1 miles, I saw all the marathoners, you know, that passed me, and my thought was, suckers. I mean, you guys have to keep on going. I'm done. I'm going to be enjoying myself, you know, see you guys later. But nonetheless, it is, that's impressive. I'll be thinking about you here this Saturday. I am clear on the other end of the spectrum. I am on this age where every day is a new reminder, I guess, on how old you are. I just came from an experience I don't know, 30 minutes ago. So here's the problem, Mackenzie. All right. I'm not an athlete, but I love sports. I mean, I love to play sports. I play on a tennis team. I like to golf. My enthusiasm has always far exceeded my actual abilities, right? That's kind of who I am. So I get this.
That's how I feel about being a lawyer.
Okay. All right. That's true. That's right. Hey, we're enthusiastic, so we sound like we know what we are talking about. Well, hey,
that
can get you a long ways in court. I guarantee you that much. But nonetheless, I got this opportunity to play a tennis match today. It was a mixed doubles match, and my partner was there, and we were playing against this former NFL cheerleader and her husband, who was a former NFL punter, and he played 15 years in the NFL about. And the problem with that, Mackenzie, is that is just not a good, that is not a good recipe for an old guy. It's just not, because you know what guys do? we try to muscle up. Do you know what guys do in that kind of situation?
Oh, yeah, totally.
We try to muscle up. Who are we impressing? I have no idea, but I apparently had to play at the same level as a professional athlete. Newsflash, I am not there. Now, I will tell you, I almost fell on my face. I once was going for a deep shot. I went back there to throw my racket to get the ball, and I stubbed my toe, almost fell on my face, but luckily I caught myself and saved that embarrassment. But hey, you know what? To each our own. Now, you actually mentioned you are going to be competing this weekend against an NFL's player's time on the marathon. What was that story about?
Right. So I was looking up, just out of curiosity, after I finished my last long run, it kind of gives you a prediction of around how quickly you'll finish the marathon.
Right.
And I was never doing this for time. Like, I just want to finish. But you know, it does.
Yeah,
it's
something to
shoot
for.
So,
yeah.
Right. I was looking up celebrity marathon times. And as it turns out, I am going to be shooting for around the exact same pace as Tiki Barber
ran
his marathon, which I was kind of pleasantly surprised with. I mean, obviously, he's not a world-class marathon runner by any stretch, but
he's an athlete.
If you're running a marathon as fast as a professional athlete, like, that's pretty good. I'm fine with that.
And then you told me that apparently just a little bit faster than Tiki Barber was none other than the talk show host goddess Oprah Winfrey. So I have no idea what that means here. Are you shooting for an NFL athlete or a talk show host? But nonetheless, I can't wait to hear how things go. I probably will get my 5 miles in and think of you for the next 21 miles. Well, this last week, again, there was a rumble in the jungle. This was confirmation week at the Supreme Court. You had confirmation hearings for Amy Coney Barrett. And in my lifetime, I have witnessed a lot of fighting, a lot of circus, a lot of pageantry when it comes to Supreme Court nominations and confirmation hearings. I mean, they're just fascinating times to be watching the spectacle of Supreme Court nominations. And so let's talk a little bit here about this week. What were your thoughts going into? What were your expectations? Did you think this is going to rival the Kavanaugh hearings? Or did you think, nah, this is going to be tame and lame? There really is nothing here on Amy Coney Barrett.
I mean, I don't know if anything could, I'm sure something could rival the Kavanaugh hearings, but I certainly do not expect this to be similar to that. I mean, in terms of the nominee herself, there's just nothing there in terms of personal character that I've heard from anybody or heard in the hearings this week that would provide any opponents with material to, you know, kind of orchestrate something like what happened in the Kavanaugh hearings. But I also think, you know, there, the climate of how process-wise, how this nomination came about is certainly very controversial. I mean,
right.
You know, we've discussed how, in my opinion, and people who have a similar viewpoint to me see it as very hypocritical what, you know, the Republican members of the committee are doing. So it doesn't, you know,
right.
We're not like thrilled about it or happy about it, but there's no, you know, you can't say like they don't have the authority to do this. Well, obviously
right.
They certainly do. So,
right.
You know, I didn't expect.
So Mackenzie, hold on a second. Mackenzie, I'm picking myself up off the floor because I just heard you say the politicians are sometimes hypocritical, and that floored me. I am picking myself up off the floor. I cannot believe you would take such a position as to say that politicians say the darndest things and sometimes appear to be hypocritical. But yeah, I get you on that one. There's just no doubt about it. They said some things 4 years ago that they pretty much are standing on the exact opposite now. I believe there's just, you know, obviously we can twist that. We can try to nuance it. But the reality is, no, you're going to say whatever's in your best interest at that exact moment. Well, to give some context before we talk about the confirmation hearing, Brooke Bolin, who is our new marketing person, she did some research and wrote a great blog this week. But she found, this was her research, it gives us some context here for this confirmation proceedings. And so there have been 164 Supreme Court nominations in the history of the Supreme Court since 1789. Now, I got to tell you, when I read that, that kind of shocked me. I had no idea it was that low of a number, but 164 Supreme Court nominations. Of those, 126 were confirmed. So apparently 38 of them did not end up on the Supreme Court. But let's unpack that a little bit further. Well, first of all, before we go any further, 126 of them were confirmed. Only 119 accepted the position.
Surprised by that.
Yeah. So seven lawyers or whoever were nominated for the Supreme Court. They were confirmed, and then they said, you know what? I got better things to do. I'm not going to accept this, and then went on with their lives. I'm curious as to what those other seven did with their lives, right?
Yeah, I mean, I was wondering, like, did they die? I don't know. Like, how someone would not accept lifetime appointment. I don't know what, you know, what you would have, what your life situation would have to be where you say like,
right.
No, I'm good.
Yeah.
I don't need to do that.
Well, I do know that, I believe it's John Adams, appointed, he needed a chief justice. And so he asked John Jay to come back and be the chief justice of the Supreme Court. And he said, no, I'd rather be governor of New York than a chief justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. Can you imagine that happening today, where someone turns down the chief justice position to be governor of a state? But apparently in whenever 1800, that was considered a better job to be the governor of New York. By the way, the resulting justice from that nomination was Marshall, who was usually considered as the best chief justice in the history of the U.S. Supreme Court. Marbury v. Madison was about that case. All right, well, again, 126 were confirmed out of 164. 12 nominations, only 12, have been rejected. Now, did that surprise you?
Well, I mean, I know that it was very rare. I don't think, you know, out of 164, I agree with you. It just reminds you how young our country is. And I think it goes back to the discussion of things being, you know, people using the term unprecedented.
Right.
Like, this is hasn't happened in a century. And it's like, yeah, but there have only been like 70 Supreme Court justices in that century. Like,
right. Yeah.
Total.
Because,
you know, so it doesn't surprise me that it's only 12 over that period of time. I mean, it's just these people have lifetime tenure. It doesn't happen, despite the past 4 years when, you know,
yeah,
as luck would have it, there have been three. But in typically speaking, it doesn't happen that often.
It doesn't. They're life appointments. They're there. It's a cushy job. It's good work if you can get it. And so right now, why would they ever leave? Though I will just say, for the record, if you are a Supreme Court justice, you are taking a massive pay cut. Each one of these justices, if they went into the private sector, they'd be making well over $1 million a year working for any firm that they wanted to. And so these guys are all taking massive pay cuts. But that's kind of interesting context, by the way.
I feel like they're okay, though. I feel like they're going to do it.
They're not hurting for money. Exactly right. Or gigs. By the way, if you're interested in some of these other stories from the history of the confirmation process, you know, those that have been rejected, the ones that had big fights, go to our blog, go to our website, Brooke Boland did a great job this week writing this blog. It's going to be up there tomorrow or on Friday when this podcast goes out. So make sure to check that out for further stories. But let's get to this rumble in the jungle, the Amy Coney Barrett confirmation proceedings. And you are telling me it did not live up to its billing. You're saying Kavanaugh was better. It had more, you know, interest as far as reality TV is concerned. But nonetheless, there were some highlights and lowlights from this week. And so, go ahead. Let's just go back and forth here. Give me a highlight for you from this last week, or if you want to start with a lowlight, you can do that as well. We'll just trade barbs here for a little bit.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think my number one highlight would be just that. I mean, the fact that it wasn't a contentious knockdown, drag out fight between the two parties was, you know, I mean, I think in large part is due to the fact that, you know, everyone kind of accepts at this point that Judge Barrett's confirmation is kind of a foregone conclusion. The Democrats had acknowledged that they don't have the power to stop this from going through. So there was really no reason to have a knockdown, drag-out fight.
Now,
however,
I will say this, I will say this right here, just to pause a little bit. At this exact moment in the Kavanaugh hearings is when all hell broke loose. You'd already went through the confirmation proceedings. There was a little bit of rumor percolating out there that maybe Feinstein was up to something, had a letter, and that is when we had the circus that came forth. And so no one is thinking that's going to happen with Amy Coney Barrett. I got to tell you, I actually wrote a tweet. I did not post this tweet, but I wrote this tweet, and I really wish I would have went ahead and posted it, or what is the correct word for that? I have no idea.
I don't know either. I don't tweet the tweets. So.
Right, exactly. Yeah, we really don't know what's going on here. But basically, here is what I wrote on it. I said, what is the over-under on how many days until the boofing allegation is leveled on Amy Coney Barrett? And I did not have enough guts to go with that tweet.
I would be very shocked if there were any allegations of devil's triangles or boofing or sexual assault against Amy, I would be as shocked as anybody.
Well, you know what?
I can say this is not going to happen.
You know what? You walked right into it. I should have made that bet with you, and you would have lost. Senator from Senator Hirono, is that her name, from the great state of Hawaii?
Yes.
Yeah. She actually asked Amy Coney Barrett, has she ever sexually assaulted anyone?
Since you became a legal adult, have you ever made unwanted requests for sexual favors or committed any verbal or physical harassment or assault of a sexual nature?
No, Senator Hirono.
Have you ever faced discipline or entered into a settlement related to this kind of conduct?
No, Senator.
Can you believe that?
Well, as you know, a question is not evidence, as the judge will instruct you, and the committee members are allowed. Now, I didn't, I know Tuesday, I guess, the hearings went like 11 hours plus break,
right,
so I didn't get to hear the last three or four senators on the committee, and Senator Hirono was one of them. So I didn't actually hear that question. I don't know what the context was. I have to imagine
Let me tell you, stop right there. There was no context. She looked, this makes me look like she would have been the perfect running mate for Joe Biden, because she is as sleepy. This is out of nowhere. In fact, my wife was like, listen to her going, Joe, what is this? It was like she was just asking some random questions and out of nowhere said, have you ever sexually assaulted anyone? And then I'm thinking, I should have posted that tweet. That would have been a perfect, I cannot believe I didn't do that. I would have had that pegged. And the answer would have been, I guess, one day, because one day into it, they asked that question, which, by the way, that was one of my lowlights, by the way, which leads to one of my highlights, which is this. GOP Senator Kennedy then decides to ask a question as to whether or not, do you hate little warm puppies?
Do you hate little warm puppies?
I do not hate little warm puppies.
Did you hear that question?
No. Was that after? Was that right after?
I believe it was after the next kind of chance he got. There were such idiotic questions being asked. He decided to ask, do you hate little warm puppies? And so, yeah, this is a very interesting time. Very interesting questions. This actually is a good segue. Let me go over some tweets. Some tweets that I wrote for this last week. Now, some of these are going to just be in draft form. And let's just have a little bit of a work session here to see whether or not you can you like these. Are we on to something with these tweets? Let's see where we can go with this. All right, here we go. Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation rumble starts this week. Let the circus begin. What do you think about that tweet?
I mean, I think that's pretty accurate.
All right. I should have done that. I should have posted that tweet. How about this one? Is the one I just referenced. Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation hearing start this week. Anyone know the over-under on boofing allegations?
I mean, that I think is fair enough. Apparently, according to you, you would have won money off of me. So
I would have
done it.
I would have. All right. This one maybe is better left on the cutting room floor. I'm not sure this one is that good. Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation hearings start this week. And to rid themselves of all pretense, a dunk tank is being installed. Yeah, that might not be a bad idea, right?
I actually think that's a great idea. I know some people who I would really work on my pitching arm for.
Right. Hey, it looks like a circus. By the way, did you see some of them put up all these pictures behind the scene to draw attention to various things? So it had a little bit of a circus atmosphere. But I got to tell you, because of COVID-19, it just didn't have the same atmosphere as what you had before. All right, here's probably my favorite one. In a shocking development, it was revealed during the Amy Coney Barrett confirmation hearing that she is Catholic. Experts will have to decipher how this will impact the court that is currently only 75% Catholic. Did you realize that?
Isn't that, I've heard that statistic before,
yes,
from time to time. And it is, why do you think that is? Is it just
I have
that
a theory.
Catholics become lawyer? Like, I don't, it's just so disproportionate.
Right. Right now, there are 8 justices on the Supreme Court. 6 of them, Roman Catholic. 2 of them are Jewish. Do you know how many Protestants there are on the Supreme Court? I assume you can do your math. It would be 0. Why is that 0 Protestants on the Supreme Court, 75% Catholic? Do you have any idea? Is that just happenstance?
No, I mean, I have no idea. I honestly have no idea.
The last couple of Protestants that I can think of would be John Paul Stevens was a Protestant. And so obviously he left the bench, but he was a Protestant. Here's my thought. I think Catholics are truer to their faith and their principles than Protestants. And since the president can't ask Catholics, hey, how are you going to vote on certain positions? But still, they have to know, well, wait a second, the Pope has come out pretty strongly on various issues. I'm not sure gun control, but nonetheless, maybe it's that Catholics are more true to their dogma, their beliefs than Protestants. Maybe Protestants are so wide and varied in the various different kinds of beliefs that are accompanied under the Protestant faith. I don't know. I just find that interesting. And I have theories, but I'm not sure any of my theories are actually accurate. But I think
it is interesting. Someone should look into, I mean, I'm sure someone has, but, you know, someone should really look into that and come up with an explanation, because it's so disproportionate to, you know, not that there's any constitutional requirement that the Supreme Court accurately reflect the demographic composition right. of the country, obviously. But it's just so bizarrely disproportionate that, you know, it just begs the question, I think.
But isn't it, because I know Scalia mentioned this in his dissent in one of the cases, I think it's Obergefell, that he said, isn't it interesting that the Supreme Court, these 9 justices, are deciding very significant policy issues, moral issues for the entire country, when not a single member of the most dominant faith is represented in this body? And so That is interesting. Why should the Supreme Court? But let's talk about that just a little bit. Should the Supreme Court be engaged in making policy decisions? I know that was a big issue during Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation proceedings. She said no. I'm wondering if that's actually the right answer. Do you have any thoughts?
You know, that was actually one of my highlights, or at least a related issue was one of my highlights. You know, I mean, obviously, I think you could guess this. Amy Coney Barrett, if I were the president, would not have been my nominee.
Okay.
Right? But that said, that's like a more of like a policy, I guess, decision on my part. There's no legitimate dispute that she's qualified, and clearly she has principles that she adheres to. So I don't, you know, it's very difficult to argue with her. And I think she gave an extremely eloquent answer when she was asked, you know, how would you, when you hang up your robe 40 years from now, like, how will you judge whether you've been, whether you've done a good job as a Supreme
right.
Court justice? And,
right.
and her answer to that, you know, that she had always acted with integrity, that she had treated everyone in her chambers and on the court with kind and litigants before her with kindness. And, you know, I really liked her answer. And I think the hearings also did a good job of educating the American people about civics. I mean, there was a
right.
lot of discussion in the hearings about what is the proper role of the Supreme Court versus the legislature versus the president.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, the nominee has certain views, and maybe members of the committee had other views, but it was very interesting. And I think people paying attention and listening to these hearings really learned a lot. And I know I had a very interesting discussion with a small group of friends last night where they were asking me, you know, they didn't understand that if in the unlikely scenario, for example, that Roe versus Wade is overturned, they didn't understand that that doesn't automatically
right.
make abortion illegal nationwide. And I
yes.
said, no, that's not actually the result of that. It would get kicked back to the states. It would just mean it wouldn't be a constitutional right. And they're saying, well,
right.
I mean, duh, why don't we just amend the Constitution? And I said, well, guys, that's exactly what, you know,
yes.
conservatives or Amy Coney Barrett is suggesting that should be done. And it's you know, impossible for political reasons, but you know, it's really like they didn't understand that before and they do now. So I think that's a highlight of the hearing, like the fact that people are more civically engaged and coming to understand these procedures of how the government works and the separation of power is really important.
Well, since you brought up Roe v. Wade, maybe we can do a whole podcast on this one day. But I actually think I could give the blueprint on how to effectively gut Roe v. Wade. I've given a lot of thought to this over the last, you know, 10 to 15 years, and I think I have the right answer. Now, will someone ask me this question? I know in the past legislators have, but I actually think I have the answer. Here's the answer. All right, if you are a state legislator, give me a call. Let's talk. But here's how you do it. You need to create state law. So state constitutional amendment would be best, preferable. But you need to pass a state law that treats a fetus as if it were a human being. Don't just cry. It's a life when it comes to abortion regulations. You need to treat it as if it is a life outside of abortion first. Let me give you an easy example. Tax deductions. Why, if someone is pregnant, are they not allowed to deduct that person from their taxes? Is it not a human being? Or is it a subset of you? I believe it is a human being. But how come government is not treating it as a human being? So I think if state governments would start to treat the fetus as if it actually were a human, then you would see maybe more protections for that that person. Any thoughts off the top of your head, or do you want to just say pass on my brilliant suggestion?
Well, listen, I feel like that position is at least intellectually honest. And I think that if you believe that a fetus at any stage of gestation is human, then it should be treated as such in terms of tax deductions, census, et cetera, et cetera.
And how would it be overturned? How would that law be overturned? It wouldn't be.
I don't think that any state would have the popular will to pass such a law. I think it's
but why? Who doesn't like a tax deduction? Who would object to, no, I don't want this tax deduction? Really? That's almost you would not win that lawsuit. And by the way, I'm offering my services free of charge to anyone who wants to pass that law and then need some lawyer to defend it. I'm telling you, put your money where your mouth is. If you believe it's a human, treat it like it's a human. Don't just treat it like it's a human for the purposes of abortion regulation. Now you're going to be exposed. And it's something other than what you're trying to say it is. That's my two cents.
No, I mean, I understand the position. I think it would have a consequence of completely outlawing in vitro and other unintended consequences that, you know, if you're going to stick with that position, you have to be okay with. And
what do you mean outlaw in vitro? Wouldn't it allow in vitro?
No, because in vitro creates embryos. So if you believe that, you know, from the moment of conception, it's a human being, then in vitro cannot exist legally under that scheme.
So they'd have
I don't think... I think in popular support, it's much more likely that, my research has led me to conclude, and I might be a little off on the numbers, but I think there's like a broad majority of, you know, a super majority of Americans that agree that in the first 12 weeks of gestation, the government should not be regulating. You know, this should be a decision between a woman and her doctor and her partner and, you know, whoever else.
That's what they believe.
Fine. There's broad consensus that after 12 weeks, there should be substantial the government should be allowed to, the state should be allowed to substantially regulate and, you know, ban abortion except for in cases of the health of the mother, the life of the mother. And I think, you know, we all have gotten so caught up in labels and a lot of people who agree with those statements identify as pro-choice, and a lot of people who agree with those statements identify as pro-life.
Right.
And we're so caught up in the labels, and we're really, it's a perfect example of an issue on which we as Americans have really been talking past each other for decades. And I think, you know, I was listening to a podcast with former President Obama just earlier today when he was talking about, you know, policy priorities and what progressives
should be. Because that caused you to run faster. I get that.
Yes, I was running very, very fast. But he was, you know, he was kind of cautioning progressives to try to, you know, you always want to have ideals of what you would love to achieve, but not to, you know, throw away the good while you're chasing the great, and, you know, be okay with compromising.
That
and,
is
and
a
part
very
of
wise
game.
Statement.
Yes, it is. And I think that's where, you know, we focus on these fringe scenarios when really there's so much consensus on these quote unquote hot topic controversial issues. Same thing with gun control. You know, that people say I'm pro gun control or I'm pro Second Amendment, and we toss these labels around and we really vilify the other side, when in reality there's so many people, a majority of people, who believe, you know, the Second Amendment is there, but they're is some space for common sense regulation.
Okay, let's talk.
And that's really what most people think. And I think, you know, we've really gotten past that. And part of the reason why we've gotten away from that is because, you know, the Supreme Court is in quote unquote in charge of so much of these, this
right.
regulation and the social issues, when really we should be focusing. I mean, I think that progressives should just give up on the Supreme Court for now. Like, let's give up. We're not going to make progress. Like, that's not the right venue anyway. Like, let's focus on actually making laws.
Now, I want to take this podcast in a direction now that probably I shouldn't, because it's going to maybe interest only me. But hey, that's all right. It's my podcast. I can do that.
It's your podcast.
Right. But let's talk about the role of the Supreme Court. I mean, you've been dancing around this whole issue of should they be crafting policy? What is their role? I have been doing a lot of research the last couple of weeks on Socrates. I am teaching this new class. And by the way, it is a great class. If you are a lawyer, sign up for this class. It's called Trials of the Centuries. And I'm doing this Hall of Fame of great great, you know, trials throughout the centuries. And we start with the trial of Socrates. And so I've been doing a lot of research on Socrates back in 470 BC to 399 BC. And one of his big deals was, I don't know if you are familiar with the Socrates story, but Socrates existed during the classical period of Greece. And so you had Athens, the birthplace of democracy. And contrasting Athens was Sparta, which believed that, no, we should be controlled by oligarchs. And I am wondering, do we not have that same debate today? The balance between democracy, ruled by the majority, as compared to oligarchs, which would theoretically, just I'm just talking at a 30,000-foot level, oligarchs are these philosopher kings. I think Socrates even used that term. These people who are wise, they're learned, you're not going to vote them out of office, but they know better than you do. And so I think this Supreme Court really kind of resembles the oligarchy. These philosopher kings, in a certain way, they are the learned people protecting minority rights and making decisions best for us because they know best. Any thoughts on that?
I mean, I think that's a theme that goes back, obviously, centuries and centuries, and that we see again and again. I was reading, I'm such a dork, but I was reading Federalist
Is this where I object to that?
Earlier. Yeah, I was reading Federalist Number 10 earlier today by James Madison.
Okay, you win, you win, you win.
Yeah, no, I'm a nerd. Where he addresses the exact same issue and how to structure a government so that we don't have, I guess, what he would call pure democracy, but there's kind of a republic form of government where, you know, there are people who are, so to speak, above the fray and, you know, who do know better. I think we are living in a time where we see that, you know, it's not always wise people that are chosen to lead, and there can be a lot of negative repercussions from that. But in terms of the Supreme Court, yeah, I mean, I do think they kind of act like philosopher kings and queens, and that is also dangerous when you're talking about minority rights or lack thereof.
But let me just throw in.
And it can be dangerous to the expectations of the people. You know, when you have something that's declared a right by judicial fiat and people kind of base their expectations on that, but then it's kind of called into question, if not overturned as a right. It really does erode the public's trust in their institutions.
Now, I want to push back just a little bit, and maybe I'm going to show my liberal side, which I really don't want to do because I'm not a liberal. Won't ever be a liberal, but I see myself maybe having some liberal tendencies. I quickly try to correct my error, but nonetheless, that being said, there's been a lot of talk about Amy Coney Barrett this week of, hey, I just interpret the law. That is my only job. And so what does the law say? What was the original intent of the law? What did the people say 200 years ago that controls today? All right, I get that. And a large part of me agrees with it. But she's also not exactly being forthright, because another thing that we know goes on in courts is called equity. And we expect judges to do what is equitable, what is right in a given situation. And maybe in a certain situation, applying the rigors, the black and white letter law in some situation is not the most loving or judicious thing to do in that context. So how does equity, doing the equitable thing, apply to doing what the law requires? Any thoughts on equity versus law here?
Well, I think it's a big issue. And I think, the more you start reading these opinions, the more you see that struggle and that tension in the court's opinions. I mean, Citizens United comes to mind,
right,
where, the majority had a certain view. And I think it was Justice Stevens who wrote a very lengthy dissent saying, this doesn't exist in a vacuum. And you can't render a decision like this, which, by the way, you're explicitly overruling precedent and overturning federal statutes, which were, at least one of which was enacted with broad bipartisan consensus.
Right.
So you're overturning those, you're overruling precedent, and you're kind of saying, like, we're not responsible for the consequences of this. And we don't have to look to how this will affect, the public's trust in institutions. And I think just as Stephen said, you have to understand that when the American people start believing that their laws can be bought and sold, we're on a very dangerous path. And I am of the opinion that that is exactly what has happened in the past 10 years since Citizens United was decided. And I think, he makes a very compelling case for, ideally things would be clear, but the Bill of Rights, the rights enumerated therein are brief sentences. And while you can make statements like, I am an originalist, I just look to the text of the law and my personal beliefs have absolutely nothing to do,
right,
I mean, it's false. I mean, nobody goes
impossible.
Around like, right, you don't exist, you're not a pure intellect without any life experience. It just doesn't exist.
I get why you say that in a confirmation proceeding where the media is going to take everything out of context and run with it, but that's just not real life. Your personal, what you've gone through in life, it does, that's your lens that you see the life through. It just is, and you can't change that. It's fascinating, this whole interplay between equity, what is equitable, what is legal. Another thing that Socrates said that I really loved, and it applies, I think, today even more than it applied in 400 BC, and that is this. Do you know, really chaps my height, when people say, like celebrities, they do these TV commercials and they say, hey, I don't care who you vote for, just go vote. Just go do your civic duty. You just need to vote, right? Have you heard that?
Vote often.
It's hogwash. You know what? If you're an idiot, I don't want you voting. There it is. I said it. If you're an idiot, please don't vote. We don't want the leaders of the free world chosen by a bunch of idiots. You know what? Read up, learn who the candidates are, have an opinion, and then sure vote. But if you're an idiot, I say just stay home. Now, how come they don't have that public service announcement out there?
I mean, I think Hillary Clinton kind of said that in 2016, and it did not go over well at all.
Right.
Let me just be clear that I do not espouse her viewpoints are not mine just because we belong to the same political party.
Right.
I don't think she should have ever made that comment. But Yeah, and I don't think there are that many people, if any, who self-identify as idiots. So
right,
it's
right.
Not like someone's going to be like, you know what? I'm a moron. I'm just not going to vote. And I think that's kind of the point, too, right? Like, we have to do a better job of, you know, educating people about their government and how it works. And it's really, really, really important. I mean, it affects people's lives every single day in every way imaginable. So it's a crucial part of life. And I think I get excited when I see people paying attention to things like this confirmation hearing and asking questions. And I get excited when things like the proper role of the Supreme Court are discussed, as opposed to, you know, did you sexually assault someone in the early 1980s? Not to minimize, like, and again, I don't want to minimize that allegation.
Right.
I have personal feelings about, like, whatever. But I think that this confirmation hearing did a much better job of, you know, the edification process was much more fulfilled in this hearing.
Yes.
And it was much more civilized. And we were talking about actual issues of consequence to our democracy.
Well, let me give you my last tweet that I wrote that's still kind of in the formation of stages, which kind of applies to what you just said. Here's the last one I just wrote. Amy Coney Barrett owes her 7 children an apology after the first day of senators asking her questions. During her homeschooling of her 7 kids during the pandemic, she had told them there is no such thing as a stupid question. Of course, the implication is there are a lot of stupid questions, and she just endured a lot of them, one of them being, have you ever sexually assaulted anyone? Yeah, when there's absolutely zero basis anywhere, any record that she had ever done that. And so, well, nonetheless, what we have
to look... I guess it's an objectionable question. Lacks foundation. You know, there's no... assumes facts, not in evidence. Like, you can object. If we were in a court of law, you know, that wouldn't... it's a completely irrelevant question. So I do understand that. But, you know, I think there's, again, this is kind of like a foregone conclusion. And there was political theater for sure on both sides. I mean, one of my lowlights was there were 2 points, and I'm trying to be fair because I don't want to be like too openly partisan. There were parts on both sides where I actually had to turn it off. Like, I just couldn't listen to it. One, and for the most part, I think most of the committee members did a pretty good job. Like, I wasn't, you know, I wasn't outraged for 9 hours on end on Tuesday watching the questioning. So that was good. But Senator Lee from Utah, like, I just couldn't, I mean, he was just going on and on and on and about things that were so irrelevant, and he just did not come across as like a personable or likable person at all. I'm talking about how much he's been persecuted as a Mormon, and I was like, what does this have to do with anything? I can't even follow what you're saying right now. And likewise, I think his name is Senator Blumenthal from Connecticut. Very similar. Like, it just, I understand that it was going to be a lot of political theater on both sides, but those are the 2 that I thought kind of went too far. And it's like, all right, we're done with the dissertation now, or the Shakespearean monologue about something completely off topic. Like, let's get back to the issue at hand. Well, but in general, I think they did a pretty good job of that.
Here's my prediction. Feel free to disagree because we are going on the record now, but this will conclude on Friday. So the day that this podcast is being released, the committee meeting, her hearing will conclude. They will vote within a week, and it will get sent to the Senate floor, and it will be approved probably 51-49. I don't think there's anything there that anyone can object to. She is an outstanding candidate. Absolutely nothing wrong with her qualifications. And mother with 7 kids, she just nailed this one. I see nothing that they can use to delay or stall. And I get the idea of we don't like it because we don't have Merrick Garland. But you know what? Hey, when you get President Biden here in a couple of weeks, which I fully expect to happen, make him be the first appointment. He can replace Breyer in the next 4 years, and you can get Merrick Garland, and we can put that matter to rest. Any thoughts on my prediction?
No, I mean, I agree. There's nothing that's going to prevent, nothing that has come to light you know, you never want to say never at this day and age, but there's nothing that's come to light as of right now that's right. going to prevent her from being confirmed. And, you know, all things considered, I think she should be confirmed. I think it would be a disservice to her qualifications, intellect, and demeanor if she were not confirmed. You know, and I think that we have to get back to a place where, you know, people on my side of the aisle can openly acknowledge that. Like, you can say, like, this wouldn't be my pick. But given the standards that we have, like, there's really not much you can say except for it kind of thinks that we're not the party in power and don't have, it wasn't our choice. Like, that's really what it comes down to is sour grapes. And as the great Kelly Clarkson said, what doesn't kill me makes me stronger. And yes. I think it will just show progressives that they have to work towards, you know, legislation and policy measures in a different and hopefully less precarious forum. So that's my prediction of what's going to happen. I don't think people are going to give up and say, well, oh, well, I guess, you know, we won't have these rights anymore. No, you'll just have to figure out how to do it in a different way.
And I don't want to rain on the conservatives parade here, but I think that they're not getting what they think they're getting. I think Amy Coney Barrett is very much a conservative, but I'm not sure Kavanaugh and Gorsuch are as conservative. I think you're going to see them move to the left, and you're going to see pretty much consistent opinions, same type of opinions that you have seen over the last 15 years with Kennedy on the court. You're going to see the exact same type of decisions. Obergefell's not going anywhere. Everyone knows that and recognizes that. That is not going to be overturned in the slightest. I think that the court is going to be the exact same as it was under Kennedy, but that's just my prediction or my thoughts. I could be totally wrong. All right. Well, thank you so much. Great, interesting week, and I can't wait to talk next week. Thank you, Mackenzie.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star review. We need your love to help us continue highlighting the funnier side of the law. I want to give a special shout out to our Vice President of Operations, Wendy Oster, without whom this entire operation would be a mess. Sean Wynn and 15.5 Features for making me sound way better than I actually do. And Ryan Kuhn and Paul Kuhn of Triplicity Marketing for our technical and computer support.